from Chief Inspector Theakstone of the Detective Police to Sergeant Bulmer of the same force. London, the 4th of July. Sergeant Bulmer, the matter of the robbery on which you are now engaged, you will please to shift over to the young man who brings you this letter. You will tell him all the circumstances of the case. You will put him up to the progress you have made towards detecting the person or persons by whom the money has been stolen, and you will leave him to make the best he can of the matter now in your hands. So much for the orders that I am desired to communicate to you. A word in your ear next about this new man who is to take your place. His name is Matthew Sharpin. You will naturally ask me how he comes by this privilege. I can only tell you that he has some uncommonly strong interests to back him in certain high quarters, which you and I had better not mention except under our breaths. I put you up to this, Sergeant, so that you may not stand in your own light by giving the new man any cause to complain of you at headquarters, and remain yours, Francis Theakstone.
From Mr. Matthew Sharpin to Chief Inspector Theakstone. Sir, my first duty is to draw up a full statement of the instructions I have received from Sergeant Bulmer. Here they are, at your service, according to my version of them. At number 13 Rutherford Street, Soho, there is a stationer's shop. It is kept by one Mr. Yatman. Besides Mr. and Mrs. Yatman, the other inmates in the house are a young single man named Jay, who lodges in the front room on the second floor, a shopman, who sleeps in one of the attics, and a servant of all work, whose bed is in the back kitchen. Mr. Yatman has been in business for many years, carrying on his affairs prosperously enough for a person in his position. Unfortunately for himself, he endeavoured to increase the amount of his property by speculating. He ventured boldly in his investments, luck went against him, and rather less than 2 years ago he found himself a poor man again. All that was saved out of the wreck of his property was the sum of £200. This sum was placed as a deposit in a joint stock bank of the highest possible character. 8 days ago, Mr. Yatman and his lodger, Mr. Jay, held a conversation on the subject of the commercial difficulties which are hampering trade at the present time. Mr. Jay told his landlord that he had been in the city and had heard unfavourable rumours on the subject of the joint stock banks. This intelligence had such an effect on Mr. Yatman's mind, predisposed as it was to alarm by the experience of his former losses, that he resolved to go at once to the bank and withdraw his deposit. He brought the money back in an envelope and asked his shopman to look for a small, flat, tin cash box, which had not been used for years, and which, as Mr. Yatman remembered it, was exactly at the right size to hold the banknotes. For some time the cash box was searched for in vain. Mr. Yatman called to his wife to know if she had any idea where it was. The question was overheard by the servant of all work, who was taking up the tea tray at the time, and by Mr. Jay, who was coming downstairs on his way out to the theatre. Ultimately, the cash box was found. Mr. Yatman placed the banknotes in it, secured them by a padlock, and put the box in his coat pocket. At 11 o'clock, he went to bed and put the cash box, along with his clothes, on a chair by the bedside. When he and his wife woke the next morning, the box was gone. So far, the circumstances of the case are perfectly clear. They point unmistakably to the conclusion that the robbery must have been committed by some person living in the house. Suspicion falls, therefore, upon the servant of all work, upon the shopman, and upon Mr. Jay. The bedroom in question is the back room on the first floor. In consequence of Mrs. Yatman's constitutional nervousness on the subject of fire, her husband has never been accustomed to lock the door. Both he and his wife are, by their own admission, heavy sleepers. Consequently, the risk to be run by any evil-disposed persons wishing to plunder the bedroom was of the most trifling kind. Such are the circumstances as they were related to Sergeant Bulmer when he was first called in to discover the guilty parties. After a week's painstaking investigation, he was satisfied that there was no sound cause for suspicion against either the servant or the shopman. That leaves only the lodger, Mr. J, who has not paid his rent for the last month. This is the plan that I have adopted, with the full approval of Mr. and Mrs. Yatman, for discovering whether Mr. J is or is not the person who has stolen the cash box. I propose today to present myself at the house in the character of a young man who is looking for lodgings. The back room on the second floor will be shown to me as the room to let, and I shall establish myself there tonight. By this means, I shall be living next to the room occupied by Mr. J. By observing him closely when he is in his rooms, and by following him closely whenever he goes out, I believe I may look forward to the discovery of his secret, as to a dead certainty. I remain your obedient servant, Matthew Sharping. The 7th of July. I am now comfortably established next door to Mr. J. The partition between us is mere lath and plaster. In this partition, I have made two holes. One I call my peephole, and the other my pipehole. The name of the first explains itself. The name of the second refers to a small tin pipe or tube inserted in the hole and twisted so that the mouth of it comes close to my ear while I am standing at my post of observation. Thus, while I am looking at Mr. J through my peephole, I can hear every word that may be spoken in his room through my pipehole. Perfect candour, a virtue which I have possessed from my childhood, compels me to acknowledge, before I go any further, that the ingenious notion of adding a pipehole to my peephole originated with Mrs. Yatman. This lady, a most intelligent and accomplished person, simple and yet distinguished in her manners, has entered into all my little plans with an enthusiasm and intelligence which I cannot too highly praise. "I may be wrong," she said to me, "but I felt hopeful of success as soon as you entered the house, and I believe if the wretch who has robbed us is to be found, you are the man to discover him." Let me now return to business. I have enjoyed some hours of calm observation of Mr. J. I have to report that he rose at a late hour this morning, always a bad sign in a young man, and that he lost a great deal of time after he was up in yawning and complaining to himself of headache. But in half an hour's time, he put on his hat and walked out. Of course, I put on my hat and walked out also. He walked straight to the nearest tavern and ordered a couple of mutton chops for his dinner. I placed myself in the next box to him. Before I had been in the room a minute, a young man of highly suspicious manners and appearance, sitting at a table opposite, took his glass of porter in his hand and joined Mr. J. I pretended to be reading the newspaper and listened with all my might. "Jack has been inquiring after you," says the young man. "Did he leave any message?" asks Mr. J. "Yes," said the other. "He told me, if I met with you, to say that he wished very particularly to see you tonight, and that he would give you a look in at Rutherford Street at 7 o'clock. "All right," says Mr. J. "I'll get back in time to see him." By 7 o'clock, I was back at my observatory post in the house. Mrs. Yatman had been kind enough to undertake to search Mr. J's room while he was out of the way, but on my return she shook her head and sighed. "Don't despair, ma'am," I said. "I expect great things of my peephole and pipehole tonight." As the hour struck 7 o'clock, the person described as Jack walked in. I am happy to say he looked violently agitated. The cheerful glow of anticipated success diffused itself all over me. "What's the matter now, Jack?" says Mr. J. "Can't you see it in my face?" says Jack. "My dear fellow, delays are dangerous. Let us have done with suspense and risk it the day after tomorrow." "So soon as that?" cried Mr. J., looking very much astonished. "Well, I'm ready if you are. But I say, Jack, is somebody else ready too?" He smiled as he spoke, a frightful smile, and laid a very strong emphasis on those two words, somebody else. There is evidently a third ruffian, a nameless desperado concerned in the business. Meet us tomorrow, says Jack, and judge for yourself. Be in the Regent's Park at 11 in the morning, and look out for us at the turning that leads to the Avenue Road. With those words, he went out. What is the natural conclusion to draw from the conversation which I have just set down? Evidently, that the Confederates meet tomorrow to take their respective shares in the stolen money. Mr. J is, beyond a doubt, the leading criminal in this business. I shall therefore make it my business to follow him at the Regent's Park tomorrow, and doing my best to hear what is said there. In the meantime, I shall want the immediate assistance of two competent persons, supposing the rascals separate after their meeting, to follow the two minor criminals. The 8th of July. I have to acknowledge with thanks the speedy arrival of my two subordinates, men of very average abilities, I'm afraid, but fortunately I shall always be on the spot to direct them. My first business this morning was necessarily to prevent mistakes by accounting to Mr. and Mrs. Yatman for the presence of two strangers on the scene. Mr. Yatman, between ourselves a poor, feeble man, only shook his head and groaned. Mrs. Yatman, that superior woman, favoured me with a charming look of intelligence. I privately winked at her. "Oh, Mr. Sharpin," she said, "your sending for their assistance looks as if you were beginning to be doubtful of success." "It is because I am sure of success, ma'am," said I, "that I send for them. I am determined to recover the money, not for my own sake only, but for Mr. Yatman's sake, and for yours." "Oh, Mr. Sharpin," she said again, and blushed of a heavenly red, and looked down at her work. I could go to the world's end with that woman, if Mr. Yatman would only die. I sent off the two subordinates to wait at the Avenue Road gate of the Regent's Park. Half an hour afterwards, I was following in the same direction myself, at the heels of Mr. J. The two Confederates were punctual to the appointed time, I blush to record it, but it is nevertheless necessary to state that the third rogue, the nameless desperado of my report, or, if you prefer it, the mysterious somebody else, is a woman, and what is worse, a young woman, and what is more lamentable still, a nice-looking woman. The man named Jack offered the woman his arm. Mr. J placed himself on the other side of her. The three then walked away slowly among the trees. I followed them at a respectable distance. Then I heard Jack address these words to Mr. J. "Let us say 10:30 tomorrow morning, and mind you come in a cab." They then separated, and I followed Mr. J back to his lodgings. Early the next morning, I was at my accustomed place by my peephole. Mr. J was occupied in dressing himself, and was taking extraordinary pains to destroy all traces of the natural slovenliness of his appearance. This was precisely what I expected. A vagabond like Mr. J knows the importance of giving himself a respectable look when he is going to run the risk of changing stolen banknotes. At 10:10, he was in the street, on his way to the nearest cab stand, and I and my subordinates were close on his heels. He took a cab, and we took a cab. We followed them for some 5 minutes before my subordinates both grinned and said, "Please to look out, sir." I did look out. The thieves' cab had stopped. Where? At a church door. What effect this discovery might have had upon the ordinary run of men, I don't know. Being of a strong religious turn myself, it filled me with horror. I have often read of the unprincipled cunning of criminal persons, but I never before heard of three thieves attempting to double on their pursuers by entering a church. We stole up to the gallery stairs, diverged to the organ loft, and peered through the curtains in front. There they were, all three, incredible as it may appear, sitting in a pew below. Before I could determine what to do, a clergyman made his appearance from the vestry door, followed by a clerk. My brain whirled, and my eyesight grew dim. The clergyman placed himself inside the altar rails. The three desperados approached him. He opened his book and began to read. What, you will ask? I answer, without the slightest hesitation, the first lines of the marriage service. My subordinate had the audacity to stuff his pocket handkerchief into his mouth. After I had discovered that the man Jack was the bridegroom, and the man Jay acted the part of the father and gave away the bride, I left the church. As soon as I and my subordinates were assembled together outside, I intimated my intention of still following the other cab, in spite of what had occurred. The two subordinates were astonished at my resolution. One of them had the impertinence to say to me, "If you please, sir, who is it that we are after? A man who has stolen money, or a man who has stolen a wife?" When the marriage ceremony was over, the three got into their cab. We followed them to the terminus of the South Western Railway. The newly married couple took tickets for Richmond, and I saw Mr. J safely home. I have only one word more to add, and it is this. If an individual ventures to assert that Mr. J and his confederates are innocent of all share in the stealing of the cash box, I, in return, defy that individual, though he may even be Chief Inspector Theakstone himself, to tell me who has committed the robbery at Rutherford Street, Soho. I have the honour to be your very obedient servant, Matthew Sharpin.
From Sergeant Bulmer to Chief Inspector Theakstone, London, July the 10th. Inspector Theakstone, your letter and enclosure came safe to hand. Wise men, they say, may always learn something, even from a fool. By the time I'd got through Sharpin's maundering report of his own folly, I saw my way clear enough to the end of the Rutherford Street case. In half an hour's time, I was at the house. The first person I saw there was Mr. Sharpin himself. "Have you come to help me?" says he. "Not exactly," says I. "I've come to tell you that you are suspended till further notice." "Very good," says he, not taken down by so much as a single peg in his own estimation. "I thought you would be jealous of me. It's very natural, and I don't blame you. Walk in, pray, and make yourself at home. I'm off to do a little detective business on my own account in the neighbourhood of the Regent's Park." With those words, he took himself out of the way, which was exactly what I wanted him to do. I went straightway to see Mr. Yatman. "About this matter of the robbery, sir," says I.
"You've come to tell me that your wonderfully clever man, who has bored holes in my second-floor partition, has made a mistake and is off the scent of the scoundrel who has stolen my money," says he.
"Yes, sir. That is one of the things I came to tell you."
"Can you tell me who the thief is?"
"Yes, sir. I think I can."
"Not my shopman."
"Guess again, sir," says I.
"That idle slut, the maid?"
"She is idle, sir," says I, "and she is also a slut. My first inquiries about her proved as much as that, but she's not the thief."
"Then, in the name of heaven, who is?"
"Will you please to prepare yourself for a very disagreeable surprise, sir?" He turned as pale as ashes and pushed his chair 2 or 3 feet away from me. "Your wife has taken it." He jumped out of the chair as if I'd put a knife into him.
"It's a lie," says he. "A base, vile, infamous lie."
He stopped and fell back into the chair again, looking about him in a bewildered way, and ended up bursting out crying. "When your better sense comes back to you, sir," says I, "I'm sure you will be gentleman enough to make an apology for the language you have just used. In the meantime, please to listen, if you can, to a word of explanation. Mr. Sharpin has sent in a report to our inspector. In most cases, such a document would have been fit for the waste paper basket, but in this particular case, it so happens that Mr. Sharpin's budget of nonsense
leads to a certain conclusion. Mrs. Yapman has been practising upon the folly and conceit of this young man, and has tried to shield herself from discovery by purposely encouraging him to suspect the wrong persons. I will undertake to give a decided opinion as to why Mrs. Yapman took the money, and what she has done with it. Nobody can look at that lady, sir, without being struck by the great taste and beauty of her dress. Finding his powers of speech again, Mr. Yapman cut me short directly, as haughtily as if he had been a duke instead of a stationer. Try some other means of justifying your vile calumny against my wife. Her milliner's bill for the past year is on my file of receipted accounts at this moment. Excuse me, sir, says I, but that proves nothing. A married lady who wishes it can keep two accounts at her milliner's. One is the account which her husband sees and pays. The other is the private account which contains all the extravagant items and which the wife pays secretly by instalments, mostly squeezed out of the housekeeping money. In your case, I suspect no instalments have been paid. Proceedings have been threatened. Mrs. Yapman, knowing your altered circumstances, has felt herself driven into a corner, and she has paid her private account out of your cash box.
I won't believe it. Every word you speak is an abominable insult to me and to my wife.
Are you man enough, sir, says I, to get that receipted bill you spoke of and come with me at once to the milliner's shop where Mrs. Yapman deals? He turned red in the face at that, got the bill directly, and put on his hat. Arrived at the milliner's, one of the expensive West End houses, as I expected, I asked for a private interview with the mistress of the concern. The books were brought, and 1 minute's look at the pages in which Mrs. Yatman's name figured was enough, and more than enough, to prove the truth of every word I had spoken. After that, I thought it best to get Mr. Yapman out of the house immediately. He was in such a pitiable condition that I called a cab and accompanied him home in it. Whether Mrs. Yapman will come cleverly out of the scrape or not seems doubtful. I should say myself that she will go into screeching hysterics and so frighten the poor man into forgiving her. But this is no business of ours. So far as we are concerned, the case is now at an end. I remain, accordingly, yours to command, Thomas Bulmer. P.S. I have to add that on leaving Rutherford Street, I met Mr. Matthew Sharpin. When may I pay you a compliment on finding the thief? Says he.
Whenever you like, says I, for the thief is found.
Just what I expected. I've done all the work, and now you cut in and claim the credit. Mr. J., of course.
No, says I.
Who is it, then?
Ask Mrs. Yatman. She's waiting to tell you.
It has been discovered that he left the house 5 minutes after this interview, his left cheek displaying a bright patch of red, which might have been the result of a slap on the face from a female hand. Nothing more has been heard of him, and it is conjectured that he has left London with the intention of offering his valuable services to the provincial police.
The Bite a Bit by Wilkie Collins was adapted by Michael Bakewell. It was read by John Rowe and produced by Rosemary Hart.